Blog Talk Radio.
Toxins are all around us, in our environment, the air we breathe, the food we eat. Just about everything seems toxic nowadays, but there are also solutions. You're listening to Sweet Remedy Radio. Empowering you with both the knowledge of what to avoid, as well as often offering unusual solutions and alternatives, as we bring you fascinating and expert guests. And now your host, the acclaimed filmmaker of Sweet Misery and Sweet Remedy, Corey Brackett.
Hello and welcome to Sweet Remedy Radio, empowering through knowledge on the Health and Harmony Radio Network. I'm your host, Corey Brackett, and I'm so happy to be joining you tonight. If you have a question for my guest this evening, you can call 914-338-0821 or leave a text message in our chat room if you prefer to do that. The phone number to call in again is 914-338-0821. Well, I am thrilled, everybody, to be able to share the wisdom and knowledge of my guest this evening with y'all. He is a toxicologist, a clinical nutritionist, a scientific researcher, and professor emeritus of food science at Arizona State University. And we'll be talking tonight about multiple sclerosis, that mysterious and frightening disease that seems to catch people completely at random and wreak havoc in their lives. I'd like to welcome Dr. Woodrow Monty to the show. Hi, Dr. Monty, and thank you so much for being on Sweet Remedy Radio tonight.
Hi, Corey. I want to thank you for having me on board tonight. This is wonderful.
Well, I'm so glad to be talking with you. As you know, I was diagnosed with MS myself, but for the folks at home, can you tell us all what MS is?
Well, multiple sclerosis is a disease. I guess we can call it a disease, but it's a malady whereby the insulation on the axons, which are the wires that basically, we'll call them wires, that transmit information from one brain cell to another brain cell or between brain cells and muscle cells. Those wires or axons are insulated. They have layer upon layer of this miraculous stuff called myelin that surrounds them and protects them from misfiring or whatever, from any kind of damage. And the body is, all of the axons of the body have got ample coating of this material. Well, people with MS lose the coating slowly but surely. Layer upon layer of the coating vanishes over a period of time. And once the coating is completely gone or almost completely gone, we can get all sorts of complications, because the communication that goes on between the brain and the muscles, the brain and other tissues in the body, just breaks down.
So it's kind of like, I mean, unlike what we're sometimes told about MS, for all of you MS patients out there, the myelin sheath is more like peeling the layers of an onion off rather than just one insulation on the wire.
If you look at a slide of a normal axon that's just been cut across, like you cut a wire across, you'll see multiple layers of this myelin that surround the that form a sheath that surround the axon itself. It's a beautiful symmetrical entity when it's working properly. It's really magnificent.
We kind of do have a good setup in the human body when it's working properly and when we give it a chance to work properly.
Yeah, exactly.
When did MS first appear?
Well, this is a fascinating topic. I mean, if you have MS, and I hope there are people in the audience that do have MS that are listening, because I think we'd like some input from them, if that's possible, during the discussion. But basically, you know, it's considered to be one of the diseases of civilization, and that's what people talk about it as being. But the fact is that some very major civilizations never had MS. There was no hint of MS, no history of MS in the Egyptians, no history of MS in the Greeks or the Roman cultures back, you know, hundreds or not thousands of years ago. It's a modern disease and probably started, in fact, the first indication of it was, around 1830s or 40s or so. And these were drawings that were done of human anatomical tissue that was done by an artist who specialized in that sort of thing. And you can in those pictures, you can see very clearly what is definitely the plaque that is the area of demyelination that we call plaque that is reminiscent of multiple sclerosis.
Was this an artist who was drawing in autopsy?
Exactly, right. That was about the time when everyone was very curious about how the body worked and what it looked like. And so there was plenty of room for illustrations of that sort. And so in one of those illustrations, or several of them, we find, around that period of time, so basically the middle of the 1800s was where we really first start seeing any evidence of multiple sclerosis at all. And at that point, you know, it was considered an extremely rare disease.
Did it strike the rich and poor alike in the same way?
No. Even to this day, MS is considered, you know, a disease of the affluent. You don't find multiple sclerosis in areas where there's abject poverty. Never. Where people can't afford, basically where they can't afford canned foods, we'll talk about it later, but where they forage for food, you don't find any multiple sclerosis.
So we're not necessarily talking about the folks in America who are poor. I mean, we might be. There might be some folks in America who are as poor as that. But mostly we're talking about people who are in other countries, third world countries, and
aboriginal people
and that sort of thing.
And foragers, people who have to forage, who have to find their food out in the wild and eat what comes by, exactly. The poorest people in the United States are not that poor.
It's kind of interesting that we actually have a disease that has a tendency to target the wealthy.
Pretty fascinating. There's a number of them, actually.
Are those diseases of civilization?
I think that's probably why we get that archaic term, diseases of civilization, because, I mean, it's more easily correlated, and this is a fascinating study that was done, you know, in the early 1900s, where you could correlate it more clearly with indoor toilets than you could with anything else. In other words, the more indoor toilets there were in a town, the more likely that town was going to have multiple sclerosis.
Well, that's an interesting theory.
It is.
Yeah, you have a theory yourself. Let's get down to the nitty-gritty, Dr. Monty. What do you think is behind the cause of MS, and can you explain that for us?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, I'm a food scientist. That was my passion, and that's what I taught for 30 years. And disease of civilization, it's also, you know, everyone agrees that it has something to do with the diet. You know, it's what you eat that's causing it. It has to be in the food. Somewhere else in the environment, perhaps. But anyway, so my thought was that if we studied hard enough and long enough and looked at enough chemicals that are in food, we would eventually discover just what it is that causes this disease and perhaps some other diseases. And the one chemical that I kept on coming back to, the one chemical that has all of the attributes, if you want to call them attributes, that would be perfect for causing this disease, is a chemical called methyl alcohol.
Oh, that's one of the breakdown components of aspartame that we mentioned in our documentary.
Definitely. I mean, it's the breakdown component that I've always been concerned about.
But methanol is in other things, too, isn't it?
Definitely. But not a lot of other things. It is, you know, in the wild world, in the natural world, it's almost impossible to find free methyl alcohol. Very rare, which is probably why we started seeing this occur recently in civilization, like 150 years ago, 200 years ago. And basically, I think where it all started, and the reason it started in the mid-1800s, is that one of the only ways you can produce methyl alcohol out of natural foods, especially fruits and vegetables, is by taking fruits and vegetables and putting them in sealed containers and then storing those containers at room temperature.
How does that end up releasing the methanol?
Well, pectin, which is a component of fruits and vegetables, most fruits and vegetables, actually has, as part of its structure, methyl alcohol. Now, if you were to eat pectin, like in the form of raw fruits and raw vegetables, we don't have the enzymes anywhere in our digestive cells that can break off the methyl alcohol and liberate it. So it sticks with the pectin, it stays with the fiber, and it goes out, and it goes into the fecal matter, and then leaves the body. But if you take the same pectin and put it, like for instance, the pectin that you'd find in apple juice, and you freshly squeeze the apple juice, well, that's fine. You can drink that, have no problems. But take that same juice and put it into a Tetra Pak or a jar or a bottle.
Now, a Tetra Pak is like a box of juice?
Yeah, yes. It's one of the companies that makes the majority of those boxes. And not even the box, even there's other shapes, the foil packets and that kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
I mean, any kind of juice that's in place in the container and stays at room temperature for any period of time will have methyl alcohol in it or methyl alcohol in it. And that's the rub, because that kind of technology didn't come along until Appert discovered canning for the French government. Okay, he won a prize for doing that. And it sort of became commercial in 1807 or 1808, somewhere around that time. But it was
in the
so
first
expensive.
Dr. Monty.
Long before the first MS, really.
And the first MS was like in the 1930s or so. So 30 years or so afterwards.
1830s, right, exactly. In the 1830s, 1840s. But canning was so expensive back then that they would can meat. And when you put meat in a can, there's no methyl alcohol to release. So canned meat, canned fish, that kind of thing, the high-value commodities that they would can in those early days would not produce any methyl alcohol. It wasn't until the canning process became more mechanized and became cheaper that they decided, well, let's put fruits and vegetables in cans, and that coincides perfectly with the slow introduction of this strange disease called multiple sclerosis, strange, rare disease in the 1800s, but it wasn't long before it became a serious disease, and then, of course, it really exploded after aspartame was introduced into the, well, you had problems with the methanol from aspartame. That's probably what caused your multiple sclerosis.
Well, you know, Dr. Monty, we've been talking a lot for the last couple of years, and I have to say I've gone on your diet for, you know, at least a year and a half or so. And I had a few nagging problems that I could not get rid of, nagging symptoms of
even
MS.
Even completely gave up aspartame, right?
Yes. Oh, yes. I had completely given up aspartame for a long time and hadn't had any of it, and I was still having these few nagging problems that would usually happen about once a month. It was no big deal. You know, it didn't really interfere with my life, but it was a nuisance. And what I realized was that I was, well, now this is going into some of the other causes of methanol in our food supply, but one thing was that I was having spaghetti about once a week or so with tomato sauce.
Yeah, there you go.
And I was using a can of tomatoes, can of tomato sauce, a can of tomato paste, a can of mushrooms, putting it all together and calling it spaghetti.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would also have wine about once a week.
Mm-hmm.
And you had mentioned that wine, being a derivative of fruit, of grapes in this instance, can that has methanol in it, correct?
It can. And it basically with the wine, you don't know. Some of it can, some of it doesn't. It all depends if it was, you know. I mean, this is the amazing thing about this. There's so much food science involved in it. I mean, you have to know the devil's in the details. You know, if you've got a person that's making wine from good, healthy grapes, fermentation will make ethyl alcohol, which is very not only safe but beneficial. But if there's some rot, some rotted fruit, you know, some rotted grapes, the rot produces methyl alcohol from the pectin. And so, it's so serendipitous that I just suggest that people, you know, be real careful with wine. If you have MS, I mean, you want to have some alcohol. You want to have some ethyl alcohol, which we'll talk about later. But probably better off drinking a little beer or a margarita or something like that. But we'll talk about
it. Tequila would be okay, even though that's from the blue agave plant.
Yes, right. Because they're very careful about not using rotted agave. It's got to be all clean, fresh material. And like I say, fermentation does not make methyl alcohol. It's rotting.
So, because most tequilas are created in Mexico, I think, correct?
Correct.
So they're really careful in Mexico, and they're probably pretty careful with their wine production in France and, you know, some of the other countries. But, like, American wine is probably, they throw in those rotted grapes, I hate to say.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure they do. And you have to just be, you know, when you've got multiple sclerosis, I mean, the good news is this is easy to do because there are not many things that have methyl alcohol. And so if you take a look at my website, which I'm sure you'll tell about people, but basically I have a list of the 10 things that you have to be careful of, watch out for.
And tell us your website.
Yeah, there are two websites. The easier one is thetruthaboutstuff.com. All one word, thetruthaboutstuff.com. And up there in the top somewhere, it has a little thing that says the Monty Diet. It's not really a diet. It's a list of things you've got to watch out for. But it's two pages, and there's the list, and it has a nice little description of each thing that's on the list and particular material that you really need to know, things to watch out for. The other website is a little bit more complex. It's got a lot of research articles, which will come in handy for people. In fact, it has all the important research articles I used to do my research. They're all there. And it's called While Science Sleeps.com, all one word. So While Science Sleeps.com.
Well, you know, Dr. Monty, since I talked with you about a year and a half ago about all of this, I have eliminated, I just went through my cupboards and I got rid of all my canned fruits and vegetables and got rid of and stopped drinking wine completely. And I haven't had a problem ever since.
So, which is just perfect. That's excellent. In fact, you were the first person, because I know you were a bit of a hard sell. I remember that, because you were, you know, you'd given up aspartame. You had some good luck, you know, with symptoms disappearing. We still had some nagging problems. And so, you were talking to me, and I'm thinking, well, Corey's going to be the first person I'm going to tell this whole story to, and let's see what happens. So I just spilled it out to you and told you the exact details and what you should watch out for. And I think it was pretty true to what those Ten Commandments are basically right now in my guidelines. But and you did stick with them, and you called me up from time to time, and it was great. It was great because I think I tell you the truth. I mean, I really developed that 2-page handout based on discussions with you and how things turned out. Because I know there are ways, you know, you don't want to tell people that they could never have spaghetti again. That was a tough one. But we found a way. We found a way using food science principles to get rid of the methanol very simply, and that's all in that handout. I mean, just basically simmering that sauce the way the Italians have done and the French have done for years and years. Simmer that sauce for 3 hours, you know, at the top a little bit of jar of the, and that boils off that methyl alcohol. It leaves, it's gone, and then you can add. And you know what? The good news is the spaghetti tastes better that way. Anyway, I think it does. Does it, Corey?
Well, I always knew that one of my favorite meals growing up was lasagna, and I always loved it the next day. Because the juices began to seep into things. And, yeah, I think the spaghetti sauce does taste better.
It concentrates it. And the neat thing about it is, and back before aspartame, of course, the Italians, although they consumed large quantities of canned tomatoes, they had a very low incidence of multiple sclerosis. Now, that changed when aspartame came along in the last 30 years because they built a factory in Italy that produced aspartame, and it was extremely cheap there. And so a lot of people started consuming it, and the MS level went up just like it did in Japan for the same reasons. But they would always, I mean, they had this way of producing the sauce that, based on, you know, homely principles that had evolved over the years. And
Isn't it amazing how we evolve certain techniques and things after years and years and years in native cultures that are naturally healthy?
It happens so much in foods. It's, you know, and as a food scientist, you know, I've learned so many of these, and so many of them are so important, and they've evolved in traditional cultures. I mean, and, you know, we don't think of them much now, but diseases like pellagra, beriberi and scurvy. You know, there were cultures that never had a problem with these at all because of simple things that they learned to do and they passed on from one generation to the other. There's a lot of examples of it. I don't want to get too much off the subject, but it's not unusual, and it's really eye-opening to discuss some of these. Some of them are not intuitive either. They had to be discovered by the cultures. They had to be, some wise person in the culture had to say, hey, look, these people are dying from this strange disease, and they do this. So we're all going to do this from now on. And it's just a miracle that happens, and it's great that it can happen. I hope we can do it now with multiple sclerosis. I think we need to,
and I think you have the answer. Mm-hmm. Dr. Monty, I really do. Let's talk a little bit about the other sources of methanol. What happened in the 1890s?
Well, we started seeing again, multiple sclerosis is very rare. It was written up as a rare disease. Charcot, the scientist who actually wrote it up for the first time. Of course, it wasn't named multiple sclerosis to the 1950s, really, but we know it's the same disease. I mean, so anyway, when Charcot wrote it up, he had a 20-year, more than 20-year, period of time when he was an active neurologist. He worked in the Salpeter Institute, which was basically the nut house in Paris, where everybody from France and the continent that had would develop multiple sclerosis would probably be sent there, along with other kind of maladies.
Oh, that's the only report. Strong mom and nut house.
There you go. But I mean, you know, he only reported 20 cases in all those years that he worked there, and so extremely rare. And that was so. That takes us into the 1880s or so. But then things started happening, and one of the first things that happened, unfortunately, was the tobacco. They came up with mechanical mechanisms for rolling cigarettes at about that time, and probably the major source, I say it's in the diet, and that's true, but one of the major sources of methyl alcohol in people that smoke is the cigarette smoke. Tobacco leaves go through a rotting process in barns. They let them hang for months, and they sort of rot, and that develops a flavor and a characteristic that they like in cigarettes. It adds to the flavor. Unfortunately, it produces huge quantities of methyl alcohol, and cigarette tobacco is cut and kept moist for the whole time, and even to the end when they're actually produce cigarettes out of it. And so cigarette smoke, if you smoke cigarettes, and there's a clear, now in the literature, over the last 7 or 8 years, they finally discovered, and this is what's been really beneficial to me in my research, and they finally discovered that cigarette smoke is causative for multiple sclerosis. After 150 years of having this disease, they've never come up with a cause. They've never agreed on anything that would be a cause. And finally, the only thing that they have agreed on so far, and this only happened in the last 7 or 8 years, and that is definitely people who smoke have a much higher incidence of multiple sclerosis and have a much higher incidence of going from going to a more progressive form of multiple sclerosis. Mm. So this is really exciting to me because, I mean, jeepers, there's only about 4,000 chemicals to be found in cigarette smoke, around 4,000. And that narrows things down tremendously. I mean, because, you know, there's how many, 4 or 5 million chemicals in the world, probably more than that. And,
well, when you talk about that, those types of figures, the 4,000 chemicals, in cigarette smoke doesn't sound that large.
No, no, no. And the major toxic substance in cigarette smoke is methyl alcohol. So that is just was so fascinating. So that really helped with my theory. And so that's one thing that happened in the late 1800s. Another thing was 1800s. 1880s or so, then the Civil War ended, or it happened during that time. And during the Civil War, both the South and the North developed these big canning industries. Okay, it went from something that was hand-done to they developed machinery that would produce huge amounts of cans. One canning machine can produce 6,000 cans an hour, you know. And so they were feeding the soldiers with these canned foods and vegetables and that sort of thing, giving them something to eat when they're at war. And the troops took a liking to this, and they got home and they bragged about how wonderful these canned fruits and vegetables were. And that increased tremendously the production and the consumption of canned fruits and vegetables. Okay, now we all know that so let's not get too complicated this. Then what else happened at the same time? And this is the really, really fascinating part of the story. in medicines, you know, patent medicines, cough medicines and that kind of thing, they always have always used ethyl alcohol as something to dissolve the chemicals that they use to make the medicine work and to make the cough syrup and that sort of thing more palatable. Extracts of vanilla and peppermint and those kind of extracts you use for cooking have always used ethyl alcohol as a nice way of extracting the flavor and the aroma of these things. Well, ethyl alcohol is taxed at a fairly high level. And so it makes ethyl alcohol cost about five times more than methyl alcohol would. And at the turn,
always boils down to economics.
That's it, boils down to economics. But here's the thing that sort of worked on the behalf of this thing. At about that same time, they discovered a way, because methyl alcohol, it's wood alcohol, they call it. You can actually make it from wood by heating wood in a sealed container. The smoke that condenses is mostly methyl alcohol. But it had a terrible, terrible flavor. But they found a way by using various methods of purification to make methyl alcohol taste just like ethyl alcohol. Okay, so here it is. We now have a substance that's one-fifth as expensive and is a great solvent. In fact, for making vanilla extract, you can't beat methyl alcohol because it's a smaller alcohol than ethyl alcohol, and it extracts more of the flavors. So you get something that smells great. And then you test methyl alcohol in the laboratory, on laboratory animals. And every laboratory animal, rats, dogs, mice, chickens even, pigs, monkeys, and if you test it on those animals, you will show that methyl alcohol is twice as safe as ethyl alcohol. It takes more methyl alcohol to kill a monkey than it does ethyl alcohol.
Well, then how come it's poisonous in humans?
We're mutated. We have a mutation that none of these other animals have. And this is the phenomenal thing, the amazing thing. Our livers and other cells in our body contain catalase enzyme, just like monkeys and rabbits and all these other animals. But all these other animals, the catalase enzyme can detoxify the methyl alcohol. Our catalase enzyme, methanol, bounces off of the enzyme. So our catalase enzyme does not do us any good, and that's our downfall. Okay, we have 1/50th the tolerance for methyl alcohol as we do for ethyl alcohol. Methyl alcohol is specifically poisonous to humans.
So this is why it was overlooked in the 1800s.
Not only overlooked, okay, it was deemed safe. Now in the late 1800s, MS started to really increase, you know, because smoking was going up. They were using methyl alcohol for vanilla extracts. They were using it for cough remedies, cough syrup. And so between the late 1800s and the 1920s or so, multiple sclerosis skyrocketed. It became the most common neurological disease during that period of time. And so a lot of scientists were starting to look at what the heck causes this. And initially, they intuitively recognized that what causes this disease has got to be a small molecule, and it's most likely a solvent. And it's in the literature. So they started looking for small molecules and solvents, but nobody ever thought of methanol because it was so safe. Nobody even tested to see if methanol would cause multiple sclerosis because it was twice as safe as ethyl alcohol. So why even waste your time with it? So some of the best minds in science, because you read some of this early literature done by pathologists and histological people and that kind of thing, who did research and looked at the brains of people with MS and And they were saying, gosh, you know, it's a disease that occurs right around the veins. It's got to be a small molecule. It's got to be, but nobody ever, no, it never came up that maybe it was methyl alcohol. And we lost the initiative. And, you know, it's like that show on television, what do they call it, Cold Case, or, you know, if you don't discover the cause of something in the first 10 years, 20 years, it's going to take you a long, long, long time because you start producing prejudices in the researchers' minds. And that's what happened. You know, to this day, they don't have any idea what causes multiple sclerosis.
It's kind of crazy when you think about it, how we can have drug companies offer us treatments and drugs for MS when doctors say even that they don't know what causes it.
That is the thing that drives me crazy. I mean, you're a drug company, and you're hiring somebody with a PhD, just got out of, you know, as an epidemiologist. Probably don't even hire an epidemiologist. You're probably hiring biochemists. And they, you know, you got them sitting in your office, and you're saying, well, they're asking, well, what you want me to work on? Oh, well, we're going to have you go into the laboratory and start looking at something to help people with multiple sclerosis. Well, the first question they're going to ask is, well, what causes multiple sclerosis? And what the heck are they going to say? Well, we have not the slightest hint. We have no idea, but we're going to work on something to help these people anyway. This is ridiculous. This is totally,
well, it doesn't seem like they could understand the disease at all, really, if they can't figure out what causes it.
No, something's going on. There's something very wrong there, actually. There's something very wrong, and I think sinister, about this whole thing. I mean, especially with the response I'm getting to my theory. I mean, I just had a major article published in the journal Medical Hypothesis, which is a journal that comes out of London.
Oh, congratulations.
Well-respected, thank you. But, I mean, well-respected journal. And, you know, I laid it on the line, the entire theory. I gave, I mean, a tremendous amount of evidentiary material. And, you know, it's real clear. It's very difficult to ignore this, but it's being ignored. And thinking, well, cheapest creepers, what am I doing
wrong? Has there been any response at all?
No, nothing serious. No, I would say nothing serious, except from people. You know, I did, when I was in New Zealand, I lived most of the year in New Zealand, and now, after I've retired from the university. And so I was asked by the MS Society in the South Island of New Zealand if I wouldn't mind giving a presentation on the theory and all the various issues. And actually, the neat thing about that was I decided, because in New Zealand you have to be so careful what you say, because they don't have quite the version of free speech that we do here in the United States. So I called up a company and asked them if they wouldn't mind making a DVD so that I have a complete record of what I said. And the two people that were there to do the DVDs were health enthusiasts. They'd heard about some of my earlier work. They were just a delight, and they did a magnificent job. They did a better job than I did, given the presentation. Anyway, it was an hour and three quarter presentation, and they did an exquisite job with it. And so that once I saw it, I'd asked them if they could, you know, maybe put a title on it or something like that, and I was going to see if we could possibly maybe make it so that I could send it out to people who were interested. And somebody suggested along the way, hey, why don't you just make a DVD out of it and see if it'll go on Amazon, or see what you can do with that. And sure enough, now we've done it, and I really like the way it turned out. And it's great for somebody who has a multiple sclerosis. It gives you a fantastic introduction. I've backed up everything I said. Every slide that has any kind of important data comes along with a reference number, that reference number, you just go to one of my, to the Truth About, so it's actually the While Science Sleeps website. Put the number in there, and the actual article that I base that information on will come up, so you could read it, make your own decisions.
Well, now, you have the DVD available on Amazon, and we also have the DVD available, and there's a special for the listeners that are listening tonight, June 8th, on my site, sweetremedyradio.com, that if you order anything from our catalog, we will send you a copy of this DVD for free because we find it so important. But what's the title of the DVD?
It's I'm glad you asked that. What the hell is the title?
Well, I'll tell you then, because I had to look it up. It's Solving the Mystery of MS.
That's it.
Because you have that big no MS symbol on the front, and it kind of makes you think that your title is no MS.
Yeah. No, it's, Solving the Mystery of Multiple Sclerosis. Is your diet secretly poisoning you or something like that?
Yes, yes. It's
always hard to come up with a title.
That's a pretty bold statement for a title. And, again, that's available at Amazon or our website, sweetremedyradio.com.
And I
want to
tell everybody, too, I mean, what's really, really important is that DVD. I mean, the most important thing for me is getting it out to people with MS, and so it is. Although it's copywritten, because I didn't want anybody messing around with interpretations of it, it is not copy protected. And the best thing you can do for me and Corey knows is the best thing you can do is if you agree with it and you think it has something important to say, please make a copy of it and send it to a friend that has multiple sclerosis or somebody you know who has multiple sclerosis.
I think that is a wonderfully kind and generous offer that you offer for that, Woody. Dr. Monty.
Well, I'll tell you the truth. If I had the money, I'd try to find a list of everybody who had MS and just send it to them. I believe so much in this. But just, you know, nobody has the resources to do that. But if you know, this is the best way. If we can just do it ourselves, you know, this mechanism by which, you know, common people can help their friends and neighbors, this is something we've got to foster because, you know, you have MS, you have any of these other diseases of civilization. Drug companies are not interested in doing anything about these diseases. They're perfectly happy.
It is so hard to find out information that is at all unbiased.
Well, I mean, they're just interested in making a great deal of money from these people who are suffering. I mean, you know, hey, I may not be right. Sure, I may have overspoke something or missed something. I don't think so. I've been doing this for 25 years. And I really feel like I'm right. But it doesn't matter. You follow this modification of your diet, which is no big deal, and you can do that right now. By the way, you don't need the DVD. Just go to my website, one of those websites, and just get that Monty's Diet. Like I say, it's not a diet, but it's a list. It's the Ten Commandments, the 10 things you got to just be careful of. In fact, stay away from. You've got to just stay away from those foods. And it's not bad. It's not hard to do. But do that.
It's not.
Do
I can
right
attest
now.
To that.
And yeah, Corey's great. Corey has been doing this for over a year, and I'm so proud of her. And she stuck to it, and, you know, it's wonderful, I think, and it can't do you any harm. You can avoid those foods forever, and there's absolutely no harm it can do. You know, if I was selling interferon,
except for that, if you crave spaghetti once in a while, and then you just simmer it for 3 hours.
No, you can do it. All you got to do is wait 3 hours, right? In fact,
yeah.
if you make a big pot of it, you can. You know, it'll tell you how to do that too. You make a big pot of it, and when you're done with it, cool it down real fast, and then put it in the bags and freeze it. Because frozen fruits and vegetables, this doesn't happen with the methyl alcohol. And you can freeze the sauce, too, or keep it in the refrigerator for up to a week. You know, it's just the stuff that's put it, you know, it's the stuff in cans and jars and bottles and stuff, even stuff you can yourself. You know, you want to put
yeah,
it
so you
right
just have
in the refrigerator.
That 3 hours of discomfort. But it's not even discomfort. It's fun if you like cooking at all. And then you don't have to worry about it. It can be simple to reheat frozen pasta sauce.
Exactly. No, it's just, you know, you gotta get the feeling for what's going on. That's why I'd like people to see the DVD, because there were some good questions asked. It was given to the Multiple Sclerosis Society in Southland, and there were people in the audience who had MS, and they had great questions, and we got a lot of stuff done. It was really pretty. It was inspiring to me. And the, you know, when I first told them it's going to take almost 2 hours, the person who ran the operation, who didn't have MS, said, "Oh, these people, their attention span is like about half an hour." I said, "Well, I mean, you know,
that's a generalization if I ever heard one, and kind
sure
of
was,
stereotype.
Yeah, exactly.
You
but
just have to say something interesting."
I know. These people were great. I stopped it halfway through because I had to change the tapes and the DVD machines, and I was there totally, even after the presentation, I was there for over 3.5 hours, and people wouldn't leave the room.
Wow.
So every occasion.
How long is your DVD?
It's about an hour and 3/4.
Uh-huh.
So it takes a while, but, hey, the neat thing about it is, just, you know, I've got lots of slides. I've got about 95 or 96 slides. So just lay back and relax the first time you see it and just let me talk. You know, if I put you to sleep
well,
or whatever.
Yeah.
If you want to.
No, you're a very good speaker, Dr. Monty. But, you know, I found it very interesting, and it's a good length of time. We haven't even begun to scratch the surface of what I wanted to talk with you about today. But I want to mention a couple of things that are not in your DVD that I think people need to hear about, because there is some questions in the community about these things. I hear a lot of people talking that methanol is a problem because it breaks down first into formaldehyde and then into formic acid. And what's the deal with formic acid? Is it bad for you?
No. Formic acid... this whole thing about formic acid is a terrible, terrible, terrible bit of misinformation. G.D. Searle and Company, the company that discovered aspartame, spent millions of dollars to get this disinformation into the scientific literature. Methyl alcohol first turns into formaldehyde, and that's what does all the damage from methyl alcohol poisoning, all the damage. By the way, all the symptoms of methyl alcohol poisoning are identical to all the symptoms of multiple sclerosis. There's not one thing that happens in MS that cannot be shown to happen with methyl alcohol after it turns into formaldehyde in the brain. I mean, that's just the way it is, brain and spinal cord, just the way it is. And so basically, no, not done. This damage is not done by formic acid. Formaldehyde disappears into the body when it's formed. But just because it disappears doesn't mean it's not doing a lot of damage. This formic acid is just nonsense. Formic acid has been used by the medical industry. We use it in the food industry to make things acidic.
Well, why did they get away with saying that formic acid is dangerous? And why didn't they just say methanol is safe if they wanted to prove that methanol was safe? Because if it breaks, does it not break down in the human body to formic acid?
It does occasionally. It can. If it finds the right enzyme, if the formaldehyde finds the right enzyme, it can be converted into formic acid. When that does happen, you're home free. You're safe. That's a great thing that happens, because then from formic acid to carbon dioxide is just another few steps, and you're safe. But that's the problem. I mean, the people who get MS, the people who get Alzheimer's, we'll talk about this, the people who are susceptible to these diseases of civilization, they just don't have enough of that enzyme available to convert all the formaldehyde quickly enough the formic acid that makes it safe, and then there you go. The reason that Searle had to come up with this stupid thing And I don't know how they got this university that did most of the work to do. Well, I know how. Money. At any rate, millions of dollars were put to really bad use by putting a bunch of bad literature into the scientific journals. Toxicological journals are notorious for working with drug companies and this type of thing. At any rate, that's just nonsense. Formic acid is not the problem. The thing is, you can't find formaldehyde. I can take formaldehyde and inject a large aliquot of it into somebody's veins. By the time they got to the hospital, they'd be near death, but they could not find any of the formaldehyde. And then they would die, and they still can't find the formaldehyde. They wanted to indicate that the formic acid is important because formic acid you can always find. You can find it in the bloodstream. It can be identified. It doesn't bind to protein and make it attractive to macrophages that cause demyelination. It just circulates in the body and causes no harm whatsoever. Just a bunch of nonsense. I mean, it's horrifying. But, hey, that's what your doctor's going to say to you when you say, hey, this guy thinks that methyl alcohol causes MS. He'll say, oh, no, this research was done that showed that it's the formic acid that caused the problem. It's not the formaldehyde. Well, nonsense. That's just nonsense. If you see the DVD or you read some of the articles that I have on my website, you'll see that that's just utter nonsense. And, you know, it's a shame because it makes it very difficult to come out with the truth when there's just so much garbage in the literature relative to methyl alcohol poisoning. The truth, there's plenty of truth there, but what medical doctor has the time to... I spent years reading all the literature on methyl alcohol. Years.
Well, a lot of doctors nowadays will read the summary of an article, if that, right?
Exactly, and the summary is quite deceiving. If you read the entire article for these articles that try to show that formic acid is the culprit, you'll laugh your head off. Their work is so dreadful. Pathetic. Pathetic. It's pathetic. I'm getting carried away here. I have to be careful.
It's pathetic, Dr. Monty.
Yes.
But what about Gulf War syndrome? Is there any relation to that and problems like MS? I thought the problems were mainly with depleted uranium, but I hear a lot of people talking about Gulf War syndrome.
Well, a lot of terrible things went on in the Gulf War. I mean, there was depleted uranium. There was all sorts of smoke and that sort of thing from the oil wells that were set ablaze. It took forever to put out. The one interesting thing that I find about this whole Gulf War thing, and that is, number one, huge amounts of diet, aspartame-containing diet soda, which is all that was available back then, huge amounts of those, that material was shipped over to the troops.
Did that have anything to do with it sitting out in the sun in the desert? Like, I hear people saying,
it wouldn't really matter. If it was sitting out in the sun in the desert, it would more quickly allow the methanol to break off. But you know, it would make some difference. But it pretty quickly breaks apart in the stomach as well. But the interesting thing was, I don't care about Gulf War syndrome as much as I care about the known statistic that the incidence of multiple sclerosis and the troops that went over there is much, much higher than it is in the general population. And that, to me, is fascinating because, again, we have a situation. We haven't talked about the other situation, but, again, we have a situation where a population is exposed to methyl alcohol and all of a sudden their incidence of multiple sclerosis skyrockets.
Isn't that amazing? You know,
well,
it's like the truth of the situation makes so much more sense.
Exactly. And if people aren't looking at these obvious things, it's just so, and again, in the tape I spend a lot of time talking about clues. You know, I tried to make it into a mystery. That's where I was having so much trouble with the title, because I was actually, a friend came up with the title. Cause, you know, it just, they saw the DVD, and I did. I tried to make it, I mean, it took me a month to get the preparation, because I know this material inside and out, but it took me a month to do that presentation, to bring it down to the level where just people with not even in some cases a high school education, could actually sit down and listen to what I had to say and see, make the connection, see what I saw, see what I saw. And so there are like five clues, and the clues are really, I think, fascinating and sort of fun. I mean, it just, you know, it's real fun if you have MS and you think this is going to help you, because, I mean, it's so, it would be so straightforward for you if it works, you know. But like anything else, this is not a disease. What I'm saying is multiple sclerosis is not a disease. It is a poisoning. And like all poisonings, you know, there's no cure for a poisoning. You just got to stop the poison, and if your body is healthy enough, it'll heal itself. And that takes a while. I mean, it just takes a while. Myelin takes a while, months to grow back, if it's going to go back. In cases where the axons have actually been broken because the insulation is gone and trauma has occurred, those axons are...
Well, it makes so much sense to me, Dr. Monty, that it is a poisoning. I mean, when I wrote my book Through the Shadows, I mentioned Goya, the artist Goya.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know anything about your theory then. But Goya was an interesting case because he painted, he was an artist, and he painted with lead paint.
Wow.
And then he would slowly degenerate as he was painting, and, you know, lead poisoning, not a very good thing. He got sick, very, very sick, and he couldn't paint anymore. And so he wasn't exposed to the lead. And so then slowly he got better, and then not realizing what the problem was, he began to paint again once he was better with the lead-based paints. And he would get sick again very slowly. And this cycle returned and returned and returned. And I think, you know, that's something that we don't think about with MS, but it makes so much sense that, you know, you're going through troughs and peaks of problems and betterness, and you don't realize why.
And see, that's such a magnificent observation on your part, because that's exactly what it does appear to be. You know, you're being poisoned. I mean, there are two things that have to go on for you to get symptoms of multiple sclerosis. One is that you've got to take in some form of methanol, so that's a mystery thing, depending on what you're eating and how much you're eating. And the other thing, which is a little bit hard for people to understand, and that is that basically there is something that can prevent methyl alcohol from doing its damage, that can prevent methyl alcohol from turning into formaldehyde. And I'm very reluctant to say this without having backup. You know, I'm going to tell you, but basically...
What you believe.
What I believe and what is actually scientifically true. If you, let's say you accidentally, you took a shot of liquor that somebody poured for you, and oops, it was accidentally methyl alcohol, and they took you to the emergency room. What they would do, they take a sample of your blood, but before they even got that sample back, they would get you drunk. They would feed you ethyl alcohol until you were plastered, and they would keep you drunk until they got the test back. And if the test showed that you had more than a certain level of methyl alcohol in your blood, they'd keep you drunk for 3 or 4 days. It's ethyl alcohol that prevents the body from converting methyl alcohol into formaldehyde. Now, there's two sides to this thing. It's a double-edged sword, an extremely serious double-edged sword. Okay. A small amount, we probably all have, most of the time, a small amount of ethyl alcohol circulating in our bloodstream because there's fermentation going on in our guts. Okay. We have a colon that's loaded with bacteria and some yeast and that kind of thing, and it's producing a small amount of ethyl alcohol. And
Dr. Monty, I have to interrupt you for a second because we only have 30 seconds left, but we can continue if you have time for a little bit.
An hour? No, it hasn't been an hour.
It has been an hour, believe it or not. But we have time. But I need to let the listeners who are live know that they'll only be able to hear more on Archive, which will be available as soon as the show finishes, which will probably, I would say, be in like a half an hour to an hour, if that's okay.
I was just going to say that don't use ethyl alcohol to keep your symptoms away from MS. Don't do it. There's dangers there. So anyway, okay.
Well, that was a good one. But,
okay.
But you know, I try to avoid every alcohol but beer occasionally now because, you know, all of the alcohols seem to have some sort of methanol or the possibility of some sort of methanol in there.
I think basically... if you want a real good, if people want a real good review of this whole ethanol thing, we'll have to do a show about that. That'll be sort of fun.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Well,
we're going to meet again.
But did you tell people that we're going to have some more? I'm going to meet with you a few more times.
Yes, actually, let's talk about that, and we should probably wrap this up.
Sure.
It's been a real pleasure talking with you tonight, and thank you so much for sharing your theories with the audience. I really think it's so important. And because of the very important nature of your work, I am pleased to announce to everybody that we will be doing a special 6-part series with you on Sweet Remedy Radio. Tune in to the second installment of the series on Tuesday, July 13th, when I'll be talking with Dr. Monte in depth about Alzheimer's disease and looking to clues as to its cause and what we can do about it. So thank you very much for being on the show, Dr. Monte.
Corey,
it's been a pleasure
talking with you. I can't believe how fast the time has flown.
It just flew by. But until next month, have a great week yourself. Have a great month yourself, and a great month to all of you, everybody. Good night.
Are you there?